This is Culturetopia, a weekly look at NPR's very best pieces about movies, books, music, and all other kinds of culture. I am Netta Ulaby, arts reporter.
And I'm Alicia Montgomery, editor with Tell Me More. This week, a master woodworker and first-generation American on his craft and his country, plus a tribute to the boombox, that 1980s musical icon. But first,
we're going to take you back to last week, when Morning Edition did a series about Detroit, Michigan. To get ready for this series, Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep watched a whole bunch of movies about Detroit, and he has this report.
It was a rough place, the seediest dive on the wharf, populated with every reject and cutthroat from Bombay to Calcutta. It's worse than Detroit.
This city has an image problem in film after film, which is probably not what the city fathers were hoping for when they made their own movies long ago. In the 1960s, the mayor himself narrated two movies. Detroit was bidding for the Olympics.
Frequently called the most cosmopolitan city of the Midwest, Detroit today stands at the threshold of a bright new future, one rich with the promise of fulfillment.
The movie showed a gleaming modern city where people of all races got along. Shortly afterwards, scores of people were killed in a race-related riot. Thousands of Detroit's buildings burned, and the city never did sell the world on that upbeat vision of itself. A harsher view came through in the 1978 movie Blue Collar. Richard Pryor stars as a discontented Detroit man working in an auto plant.
Everybody know what the plant is. The plant just short for plantation.
Pryor's fellow auto workers include a young Yaphet Kotto, shafted by the company and by his union.
They pit the lifers against the new boy, the young against the old, the black against the white. Everything they do is to keep us in our place.
Questions of Detroit's race relations run through several films, even the comedy Gross Point Blank. A local man returns home after 10 years away.
Miss Canetta, it's Martin.
Martin, my God! You've been Detroit's most famous disappearing act since White Flight.
Gross Point Blank is set in an overwhelmingly white suburb, all brick homes and perfect lawns. Most of the movie 8 Mile takes place in an overwhelmingly black central city. The rapper Eminem rides a scummy bus, looking out the window at collapsing buildings. Left behind people try to start up leftover old cars. They drive to a grand old movie palace that's been converted into a parking garage.
You know how many abandoned buildings we have in Detroit? I mean, how are you supposed to take pride in your neighborhood with that next door? And does the city tear them down? No, they're too busy building casinos and taking money from the people.
And yet it's in Detroit's wreckage that the movies sometimes find beauty and meaning. The movie Gran Torino stars Clint Eastwood as a retired auto worker in Detroit. He turns a gun on some of the Asian immigrants who've moved into his rundown neighborhood.
Get off my lawn. Did you hear me? I said get off my lawn now.
The angry old man is slowly won over as a fearless young immigrant offers him an education.
You should be hanging out with your own people. The other Hmongs.
You mean Hmong? Yeah. Hmong, not Hmong.
Where the hell is Hmong? I mean Hmong, anyway.
No, Hmong isn't a place. It's a people.
The original screenplay for Gran Torino set the story in Minneapolis, but Clint Eastwood moved it to Detroit instead. Partly that was for a tax break. Partly it was for symbolism. Minneapolis is a nice place to live, but Detroit is an icon. Even its dead smokestacks and shabby homes suggest a rough American power, even beauty. Maybe the filmmaker Quentin Tarantino shared that feeling since the first screenplay that he sold was set in this city. True Romance featured the tale of gangsters and a call girl whose words might sum up the mystery of Detroit.
I had to come all the way from the highways and byways of Tallahassee, Florida, to Motor City, Detroit, to find my true love. If you gave me 1,000,000 years to ponder, I would never have guessed that true romance and Detroit would ever go together.
This young woman has adopted Detroit, and you can see that city is reflected in the movies at npr.org.
If you, like me, are a real fan of that movie, you will recall that actually just the first 20 minutes of it are set in Detroit before the two main characters bust out and go to Los Angeles.
From the films of Detroit, we're turning now to the furniture of California. Sam Maloof makes furniture. It's been exhibited in the Smithsonian and the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and he's actually won one of those MacArthur Genius Grants. He's credited with help launching the California Modern Arts Movement. Netta, I understand that you visited Maloof's studio near Rancho Cucamonga, California.
It's really called Rancho Cucamonga, too.
And here's the story.
Sam Maloof is shuffling around his shop. He's frustrated. The 93-year-old just got out of the hospital, and he's under doctor's orders not to pick up a tool. His three associates are busy finishing what he's carved and cut out earlier. They've each been with him for more than 20 years.
This is David Wade, who works with me.
Hey, Sam, how are you doing?
Oh, so, David. Yeah. They want this big railing, too?
They want the railing, too, yeah, both sides.
Wade's refinishing a communion rail Maloof created for a church in the 1980s. But Maloof is best known for his elegantly minimalist furniture. Maloof taught himself woodworking after serving in World War II. He had no money, lots of ideas, and a new wife.
She bought a little track house for $4,200, which now is probably worth $400,000. It didn't have any furniture in it. Plywood floors, no carpeting or anything. And so I put rugs down, and then I found a lot of scrap wood, and I made furniture out of it for the house.
Back then, no one designed furniture specifically for tract houses. Maloof was onto something new that meshed with California's evolving design aesthetic, long, low, and modern. At a moment when Americans were enthralled by mass-market, factory-manufactured goods, Maloof went the other way. He became friends with potters, people who made stained glass. They were a community, then a movement. Maloof says making things by hand is part of a family legacy.
My mother did beautiful lace work, just beautiful lace work. And they peddled it, and that's how they started out. They were peddlers.
Eventually, Maloof's parents opened a department store in Chino, California. At home, they stressed education. Most of their kids became teachers, principals, scholars.
I'm the only one that didn't go to college. I became a woodworker.
How did your parents deal with that?
About me being a woodworker? Oh, my father and mother loved it, but I was sort of the black sheep.
The black sheep caught grief from family in Lebanon about his vocation.
Yaharom Shum Ibn Amma is a failure. He works with his hands.
Today, Sam Maloof's home is a state-designated historic landmark, nestled in the green-gray foothills of California's San Gabriel Mountains. The hand-built redwood building with its blue roof, intricately carved doors, and hobbit hinges is open once a week for public tours.
Welcome to Maloof.
Thank you.
We've got about 5.5 acres here. On the tour, we're going to really cover Sam's life and his furniture, of course.
Docent Tony D'Angelo is guiding around a couple of retired wood geeks.
Is this a handmade screw out of wood? Because
yeah.
I noticed...
Janet Jensen and her husband Bob are also wowed by Maloof's world-class collection of Pueblo pottery, tribal masks, antique carousel horses, wood prints, oil paintings, Kachina dolls, all jostling for space with Maloof's sculptural furniture.
That tabletop is Tasmanian eucalyptus burl.
That would look great in my house.
Maloof built his house room by room as he earned money for materials. It glows like an ember, its pink and orange walls lit through golden glass. And it's warm with wood, from the buttery swirl of bird's eye maple to the dark chocolate of burnished walnut. Sam Maloof's rocking chairs start at about $25,000. So Janet Jensen says she'll just settle for sitting in one.
Do you know what? It's almost like it has a cushion in it, but you slide right into it and it's wood. How can that be? Yeah.
Maloof feels the wood. He works with the grain. He does not use plans. Jeremy Adamson curated a Sam Maloof retrospective at the Smithsonian, and he's written a book about the artist. He says Maloof's instincts come from decades of experience, but also a deep, almost spiritual connection between material and man.
All the parts come together in a very rational way, but they meet each other in such sort of joyful connections. There seems to be a pleasure that the leg fits the chair. They're happy to be together. It's as though they really have grown together.
When Sam Maloof was still struggling to support his family, he turned down several lucrative offers to mass produce his furniture on principle. Over the past 50 years, he's carved over 5,000 pieces. He cannot stand this doctor-ordered idleness.
It's awful hard. It's awful hard. But I'll keep working until I can no longer do anything. But I've got so much work ahead of me, I have to live to be 100 to get it all completed.
The black sheep of the family who never went to college now has 3 honorary degrees. Malouf once said, when making furniture, start with the legs. They're like values, principles, beliefs. Choosing the arms is like choosing friends. And the seat steadies a person looking ahead towards goals and the future. Ideas a woodworker could have learned from 2 young immigrants who came from Syria more than 100 years ago. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
I have to tell you, Alicia, one thing I didn't have time to talk about in that piece was that he has this beautiful, unbelievable garden.
Oh, really?
It's filled with, like, orange trees and lemon trees, and it feels like being in the Mediterranean. It's like being in that part of the world. It's incredibly beautiful. And there are pictures of it on the website and pictures of his furniture as well, a beautiful gallery. Sam Malouf was 93 years old, but someone who is really, really old, William Shakespeare. 445 years old had he lived. City of Chicago decided to mark this birthday by declaring an official Talk Like Shakespeare Day.
In Chicago. And NPR's David Shaper was there, and he had this report.
How doth thou talketh like Shakespeare?
Instead of saying, hey you, hark thee, or prithee.
Barbara Gaines, founder and artistic director of the Chicago Shakespeare Theater, says, to talk like Shakespeare, thou replaces you, and when in doubt, use ETH at the end of a verb.
If you can rhyme something, that's brilliant.
Of course, some of Chicago's most dramatic theatrics take place on the political stage. So we've come to the back room of the Chicago City Council to catch some aldermen talking like Shakespeare.
No, I'm not going there.
Alderman Tom Allen wouldn't even try.
I think Chicagoans have their own unique dialect, and it doesn't sound very much like Shakespeare.
True, but that didn't stop Alderman Emma Mitz from giving it a try on one of her pet issues.
My cousins may think thou shouldest support another Walmart in the city of Chicago.
Veteran Alderman Dick Mell tries a few Shakespearean bars.
I would like to have my beef-witted colleagues support the barnacle-bladdered boar pig ordinance that I have presented today.
In his 35 years on the city council, Mell says he's seen many a Shakespearean plotline unfold.
Et tu, Brute. I think a lot of us have been stabbed in the back, unfortunately.
Did I mention that's Rod Blagojevich's estranged father-in-law?
Beer, old style!
Beer, here!
Another Chicago arena that's home to many a Shakespearean-like tragedy is Wrigley Field.
Who's thirsty, old style?
Beer vendor Vince Pavilonis tries a Shakespearean sales pitch.
To drink or not to drink, that is the question. Who's thirsty?
As for the fans, 15-year-old Corey Sparlin of Chicago quickly finds a Shakespearean way to insult the other team.
What fools these mortals be!
Chicagoan Sean Johnson teareth into the Cincinnati pitcher.
You artless founding bat pig!
Art and Claire Corman are fans of both the Cubs and Shakespeare, so when the game takes a tragic turn...
Home run, right field.
Yeah, but we have to grieve. How would Shakespeare grieve?
Alas, poor Cubbies.
Alas, poor Cubbies.
I knew them.
It was a long one.
Yes.
And long gone.
The Cubs cometh back and winneth this game. So in thy words of Shakespeare, all's well that ends well. So fare thee well. 'Tis David Shaper, NPR Newseth, on Talk Like Shakespeare Day in Chicago.
I actually am a big fan of Shakespeare, Netta, and I don't think I've ever heard it said quite that way. In Chicago, apparently they have a real appreciation for it as well. On Tell Me More, we recently heard from a poet who's a little bit more contemporary than Shakespeare. Her name is Gail Danley, and she's a local to the Washington, D.C. area slam poet, and actually a national champion. She came to our studios to recite a piece for National Poetry Month, and it was a very personal poem for her about her own journey to becoming a championship poet. And here's a bit of her performance.
This poem is about one of those moments when everything comes together in your life, and It almost feels like it erases all of those horrible mistakes you made and makes everything clean and makes everything right. It's actually untitled, but how about we call it The Dream? Sometimes it's best when you don't know where you're going. When the road in front of you is as dark as the road behind, there are no street signs. So you drive inside of a night so black, even the street lights are afraid to come out. The other day, Mama waved goodbye to you as you backed out of the driveway. You had no road map, but you knew wherever you were going would be better than where you were, would be where you would be your new home. See, 3 weeks ago, the bookstore cashier, with her green hair and her piercings, told you you should go compete at the National Poetry Slam Championships, and you had never heard of that. But you figure anything beats subbing kindergarten with their sticky fingers and farts, and so you go. You borrow $50 from Mama. You grab a box of Fruit Loops. You rent a Chevy, and you go. Asheville, North Carolina, greets you like a warm, chubby auntie. You have no money, so you sleep on other poets' hotel room floors and dig into your box of cereal. But at night, you are rich. The microphone makes a silver halo around your head. You look inside of her, and you see clearly. Clearer than in fifth grade, when Patrice kicked your butt by the monkey bars. Clearer than Mrs. Anderson declaring you would never succeed. She needs to take her crystal ball back to Target because it's not working. Clearer than the chant, "You're so stupid, Gail. You're so stupid, Gail. You can't do anything right." Clearer, stronger, better. The judges rain tens down on you like confetti, and you are a winner for once in your life. A box of cereal, a rented Chevy, $50, and a champion. National Poetry Slam champion. A winner for once. You know, sometimes it's better when you don't know where you're going. Only where you've been and where you refuse to go again.
You know, Gail Danley, she is this tiny woman. And the thing about Gail is that she just projects this warmth. And I think you can sort of hear it in her poems. But beyond that, I'm someone who's done a little bit of writing myself. And if you listen very closely during her performance, you could hear the page turn. And the reason why is that Gail does not type her poems. She does not use a word processor. She carries around these composition books that I think just about every person who's ever kept a journal is familiar with. And any aspiring writer has a cardboard box full of those kinds of composition notebooks. And Gail is someone who's, you know, she hasn't had to give up sort of that homemade feel of her poetry to be successful and to get it across. And so I find her sort of personally inspiring. And to hear another poem by Gail Danley, you can go to our website, npr.org.
Today's generation uses iPods. Before that, CDs. You and me, Alicia?
Boomboxes.
That's right. It's been 20 years since boomboxes were a common sight on American streets. NPR Music's Franny Kelly presses rewind on this artifact of American history.
You could take your music with you and play it loud, even if people didn't want to hear it.
Decibels, power-packed bass, blasting out on street corners.
Starting in the mid-70s, you could buy them anywhere, and they weren't too expensive. Young inner-city kids lugged them around, and kids in the suburbs kept them in their cars. They weren't just portable tape players with the speakers built in. You could record off the radio, and most had double cassette decks. So if you were walking down the street and you heard something you liked, you could go up to the kid and ask to dub a copy. And I'm the G-double-E-the-M-A-N, and I want you young ladies just to understand that I'm setting my love from land to land. This was music on the move. They were soon called boomboxes, or ghetto blasters. But to the most of the young kids in New York City, it was just a box. And the manufacturers noticed, says Fred Brathwaite, best known as Fab Five Freddy.
People that were big fans of music at the time were into higher fidelity, better quality sound, bass, mid-range, and treble. So as they listened to what the consumer, what the young hip kid on the streets of New York wanted, we wanted bass. Like that feel of the boom, boom, boom was exciting, you know? And so they began to give more bass and more boom.
The boxes had to be big to make that bass boom. The speakers in early boxes had extra large magnets to push all that air around, and they were housed in heavy metal casing to deal with the vibrations from all the bass.
I remember some boxes were so big they required 20 D-sized batteries to an already heavy box. So these boxes were literally so heavy that some cats that would carry their boxes all the time, they would develop massive forearms and biceps. And then some boxes got so big and like unwieldy. Did you see guys at big events pulling a massive box on wheels?
The boxes were part of a style. It included white Adidas and big gold chains. Freddie was a video director and a graffiti artist at the time, and he took his box everywhere.
I traveled with my massive boombox. I mean, that thing moved with me, you know. I remember, like, being on the plane, and it couldn't go in the overhead bin. But that was my baby, you know. It traveled first class right along with me, you know.
But the trappings of this new culture were secondary to the music. This was the dawn of hip-hop, and it might not have happened without the boombox.
A big part of this hip-hop culture in the beginning was putting things in your face, whether you liked it or not. That wasn't always, you know, maybe it might not have always been the right thing or the right way to do it, but that was representative of the culture. Whether you like this or not, it's in your face. That was the graffiti. That's like a breakdance battle right at your feet, you know what I'm saying? Or this music blasting loud, whether you wanted to hear it or not.
As the 80s wore on, cities started enforcing noise ordinances. The Walkman became popular, was lighter and cheaper. Gradually, people stopped listening to music together. We stopped doing a lot of things together. The rap community left the corner and moved online. We still pass songs around, except now it's on file-sharing sites and blogs. We try not to bother anybody, so we put on headphones and don't make eye contact. These days, you don't see or hear many boomboxes. Except at Lyle Owerko's house. He collects them. He keeps most of them in storage, taped up in bubble wrap. He stacked up a few in his living room to show them off.
This is the GF9696, and it's absolutely my most mint box. It's incredibly shiny. It's 40 watts. The speaker grill's detached, which makes it look really mean.
Lyle's collection of 40 boxes includes Lasonics and Sanyos, JVCs and Crowns. He photographs them and blows the prints up to make the boxes look even bigger than they are in real life.
The Sharp GF777 was pretty much when boomboxes peaked out in size. This one was what you played in a subway station when you were with your breakdance crew and you wanted the music loud and you to be heard. And it had double cassette deck. It was great for dubbing cassettes, for making mixtapes, all of that. And a lot of knobs and dials, which was also always desirable because it made it seem like you knew what you were doing.
Boxes didn't stay cool forever. They started to be made from plastic and decorated in neon colors and flashing lights. They were sold to people who didn't care about sound. They just wanted to look like they were down.
Towards the end of any culture, you have the second or third generation that steps into the culture, which is so far from the origination. It's the impression of what's real, but it's not the full definition of what's real. It's just cheesy.
Today, Lyle uses his collection as props on photo shoots, and he says the sight of them sends everyone from models to art directors down memory lane. Vintage boomboxes sell for upwards of $1,000 now, and everyone who had one back then is kicking themselves for not holding on to it. Fab Five Freddy misses his box, too, but at least he can go visit. It's on display at the Smithsonian's Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. The nostalgia for boomboxes isn't just about a trend in stereo equipment. When the music was loud and unavoidable, we had to listen to each other. Maybe we miss boomboxes because when we're wearing headphones, we can't talk to anyone else, which makes it hard to help each other out. It makes it hard to party.
Or if you're my neighbor, you can just park in front of my house and blast your car radio at 2 in the morning.
You know, there was a connection between our the story today about Detroit movies. Well, kind of a 6 degrees of separation connection.
I was thinking that too.
Exactly. I mean, who can forget John Cusack holding the boombox above his head in the 1980s romance movie Say Anything? It made every little nerdy girl like me fall in love with Lloyd Dobler.
You know, what I was thinking was, I grew up right outside Detroit. My very first concert was Run DMC in Detroit in like 1988.
Oh my goodness.
It's still one of the best shows I've ever seen.
And if you want more of this great show, please take a look at the Culturetopia page of NPR.org.
I'm Netta Ulabim.
And I'm Alicia Montgomery.
Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.